Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Newsdesk Extra. To mark the launch today of GuardianAmerica.com, the Guardian's new website for the United States, we have an exclusive interview with Hillary Clinton. Senator Clinton is the front runner for the Democratic presidential nomination, and she stands a real chance of becoming America's next president. In this interview, she tells Guardian America editor Michael Tomasky that, if elected president, she will rescind some of George Bush's newly acquired executive powers and make healthcare a priority. You can follow the build-up to the US elections with our expert writers and commentators at GuardianAmerica.com. And for a daily digest of stories from the US, the UK and around the world, you can subscribe to Newsdesk, our daily news podcast, at guardian.co.uk/podcasts.
I want to start with some questions about foreign policy and terrorism. And I've been interested in your views on executive power, because it occurs to me if you become president, you'll enter the White House with far more power, say, than your husband had. And that power, of course, will have been gained through the actions of an administration whose view of executive power is seen by many people as dangerous. So what is your view of this, and what specific powers might you as president relinquish or renegotiate with Congress? For example, the power to declare a U.S. citizen an enemy combatant.
Well, I think it is clear that the power grab undertaken by the Bush-Cheney administration has gone much further than any other president and has been sustained for longer. Other presidents, like Lincoln, have had to take on extraordinary powers, but would later go to the Congress for either ratification or rejection. But when you take the view that they're not extraordinary powers, but they're inherent powers that reside in the office, and therefore you have neither obligation to request permission or to ask for ratification, we're in a new territory here.
Right.
And I think that I'm going to have to review everything they've done, because I've been on the receiving end of that. There were a lot of actions which they took that were clearly beyond any power the Congress would have granted, or that, in my view, was inherent in the Constitution. There were other actions they've taken which could have obtained congressional authorization, but they deliberately chose not to pursue it as a matter of principle.
I guess I'm asking, can a president, once in the White House, given this power, actually give some of it up in the name of constitutional principle?
Oh, absolutely, Michael. I mean, that has to be part of the review that I undertake when I get to the White House, and I intend to do that.
I want to ask a historical question about foreign policy. I'm sure you're aware that liberal intellectuals and foreign policy thinkers have, since the start of the Iraq War, been engaged in a very intense debate about Iraq and the legacy of Cold War liberalism, going back to Truman and Acheson. And it's a debate about whether the right lessons have been learned from the past, which in turn has real ramifications, I think, about the future conduct of foreign policy. So that said, do you think the Iraq War was or was not within the tradition of Cold War liberalism we associate with Truman and Acheson?
You know, that's a very hard question to answer with any certainty or even full intellectual understanding, because we are in a post-Cold War world, and I think that the argument has been missing that basic premise. It's hard to take what was a philosophy with respect to the use and containment of power during the Cold War and try to shoehorn it into a post-Cold War context. So I don't really think that there is an easy or satisfying answer to that. You know, obviously, if you read my article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, I think we can have an approach that tries to project power and authority in an appropriate way, that draws on all aspects of American power, that inspires and attracts as much as coerces. If we avoid false choices driven by ideology and theory, one of the lessons that I think we all should take out of the last 6.5 years is that ideologically driven foreign policy that is not rooted in a realistic assessment of the world as we find it today is not likely to result in any positive outcomes.
Yeah. Do you think that the terrorists hate us for our freedoms, or do you think they have specific geopolitical objectives?
Well, I believe that terrorism is a tool that has been utilized throughout history to achieve certain objectives. Some have been ideological, others territorial. There are personality-driven terroristic objectives. The bottom line is you can't lump all terrorists together. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to do a much better job of clarifying what are the motivations, the raison d'etre of terrorists. I mean, what the Tamil Tigers are fighting for in Sri Lanka, or the Basque separatists in Spain, or the insurgents in El Anbar province may only be connected by tactics. They may not share all that much in terms of what is the philosophical or ideological underpinnings. And I think one of our mistakes has been painting with such a broad brush, which has not been particularly helpful in understanding what it is we were up against when it comes to those who pursue terrorism for whichever end they are seeking.
So you sound like you're saying it's not particularly useful when Bush and others say they hate us for our freedoms.
Well, some do, but is that a diagnosis? I don't think it's proven to be an effective one.
Just quickly on Iraq, you know the Washington Post poll that I think now is 3 weeks old, that 67% of the respondents to that poll said either cut off funding or attach the funding to timetables. That's 67%. So why is it so hard to do that?
Well, actually, I support that position. Yeah. I voted against funding. I have voted a number of times for timelines, but the bottom line is we don't have enough Republicans who are willing to depart from the president's policy. And we have a very narrow majority in the Senate. And until we can persuade enough Republicans to defeat a threatened filibuster, we can't cut off funding. We can't attach timelines. I think the House could get a vote to attach timelines. I don't know whether they could take the step of cutting off funding, but they might be able to do it as a result of a series of actions. But in the Senate, you know, we have a 51-49 majority, and for most of the year until Tim Johnson returned, we had a 50-49 majority. And you're not going to see the Republicans lining up until they're absolutely convinced that they have no other alternative, and that's what we're trying to convince them of. We've got an election year coming up. I think we'll continue to try to push the president, but the political reality is we don't have the votes.
I want to shift to a couple of domestic issues. About Michael Mukasey, in light of his comments Thursday on torture and waterboarding and related issues, will you vote to confirm him?
Well, I'm going to look at the entire record of the hearing. His questions in a number of areas raised issues for me, so I have to look closely and see, you know, what I think I should do in terms of voting, and I will be doing that.
What were you most concerned about?
Well, there were a number of issues. Obviously, I do not believe in as expansive a definition of executive power. And some of the questions on the second day about presidential authority with respect to interrogation also concerned me.
You know, there's one criticism of you among some progressives is that you're an overly cautious politician. So I wonder if you can name one issue during your Senate tenure on which you risked political capital, really stuck your neck out in behalf of a progressive policy goal that wasn't a safe issue.
Well, I think, you know, voting against funding, you know, that, what did we get, 12, 13, 14 votes? You know, a lot of people who consider themselves very progressive who voted against authorizing the war in Iraq were not with me on that vote.
Previously in your on domestic issues?
Well, you know, I've made so many votes, Mike, and I've tried to vote as I thought was the right thing to do. And if you look at my voting record, as it's evaluated by most of the progressive organizations that look at voting records, I have a very, very high percentage of having voted with them. So I don't quite know what their concern is. You know, look what I'm doing in the, you know, campaign. I'm obviously running on my plans to change the country. I have very specific policies that I've rolled out day after day. I'm zeroing in on what I think should be done to restore America's leadership in the world and rebuild a strong and prosperous middle class and reform the government. And I think the results speak for themselves. We're getting an enormous amount of support because people, you know, understand that change is just a word if you don't have the strength and experience to make it happen.
A last quick question, if I can. Will health reform come first in your administration before the 2010 midterms, or will you start smaller and lead up to that?
It will be my highest priority as soon as I am inaugurated.
Guardian Unlimited.